10 years ago, the ACLU of Pennsylvania and the law firm of Caries, Radofsky, Messing, and Feinberg filed a federal lawsuit on behalf of 8 Black and Latino men who had been racially profiled by police. That lawsuit, Bailey et al. Versus the City of Philadelphia, is responsible for a decade's worth of data released by the city showing the racial disparities of a police practice known as stop and frisk. Even today, the numbers still reveal the police's overwhelming use and misuse of stop and frisk in communities of color. A decade later, what have we learned from this lawsuit? And why do civil rights lawyers and police agree it's important that we keep tracking the data? I'm Malcolm Burnley. This is The Why. David Radofsky is one of the civil rights lawyers who filed the case and has been tracking stop and frisk data ever since. He says stop and frisk has been a tactic for years, but it ramped up after a U.S. Supreme Court case in the 60s, Terry versus Ohio.
Police officer saw three men. He thought they were casing a downtown store for a possible robbery, stopped them, found a weapon, and that person was charged and challenged the stop on the grounds that the Fourth Amendment requirement of probable cause had not been met. The Fourth Amendment talks about unreasonable searches and seizures and talks about no search warrants without probable cause. And the police admitted that. We didn't have probable cause that he had committed the crime. We had no evidence that he had a weapon. But his actions with his two friends going back and forth, looking in the window, looks like they were casing the place possibly for a robbery. We wanted to intervene before. And the court had never before authorized a police intervention, which involved a type of search or detention without probable cause. Supreme Court ruled 8-1 in favor of the state of Ohio that an officer had the right to detain somebody for a short period of time, ask some questions if they had what the court called reasonable suspicion of criminal conduct as opposed to probable cause. So Terry cleared the way legally for police departments to engage in stop and frisk, which is why it was a landmark case. And since that time, we're now talking more than 50 years ago now, police departments generally have moved to more proactive preventive policing. And therefore, stop and frisk has become a central program policy in certainly every major city police department and even in small police departments.
How has this played out in Philadelphia in the last few decades?
Mayor Nutter ran for mayor in 2007. There had been a spike in violent crime in Philadelphia around that period of time. And he actually ran on a campaign of increasing stop and frisk. And it was one of the campaign promises that they actually kept.
The focus is on public safety to change the mindset of an individual who more than likely would normally carry a weapon to get them not to carry that weapon.
After his election, we, people in our office, civil rights lawyers, ACLU, started to get a huge number of complaints from areas all around the city from people who claimed they were repeatedly stopped, they had done nothing wrong, and when they asked why they were stopped, police officers often said, we were just told, anybody looks out of place, stop them. And if you have grounds, you can frisk them as well. We looked at some of the data. It was hugely racially disparate. In a city at that point, which was about 50% Black and Latino versus white, the stop rate of minorities was 85 to 90%. We assembled the lawsuit, 8 or 9 plaintiffs, all of whom had suffered repeated stops, had done nothing wrong, and we made that a what we call a class action. They were filing suit on behalf of the entire population of Philadelphia.
And what did you learn from talking to the plaintiffs about the emotional toll that being stopped illegally had taken on them?
It was very instructive for us, talking to clients, talking to people who made complaints.
My name is Fernando Montero, and I was one of the plaintiffs in the class action lawsuit against stop and frisking in Philadelphia. At the time of the Bailey case, I was an ethnographer at the University of Pennsylvania working with a wonderful team of anthropologists. We were living in North Philadelphia doing research on policing and mass incarceration. And coincidentally, on our very first visit to the block that we eventually moved into to do our research, we got stopped and harassed by the police, along with several of our neighbors.
It wasn't just, you know, a technical violation of my rights. I really felt dehumanized by that process.
Oh, it was deeply unnerving, especially because I was not expecting that level of violence. I got called racial slurs. My mentor, Philippe, and I were both pushed against the wall and spread-eagled because the police assumed that the fact that I wasn't calling the police on street dealers meant that I was participating in dealing myself.
And, you know, and one of the downsides of a police operation that isn't done right is they lose the confidence of the community. I mean, the police often complain people don't cooperate. We got a murder here. Nobody will talk to us. Well, one of the reasons they don't talk to you is that, you know, they're suspicious of what you're doing.
Everybody comes to hate them. It's really remarkable.
So what was the outcome of the lawsuit that you filed?
The city agreed to three major provisions. First, that they would retrain the officers. They would take disciplinary action if necessary against officers who repeatedly engaged in stops without reasonable suspicion. They agreed to create an electronic database of all the stops. Before, we were working from hard copy. On a quarterly basis, our team and their team would look at each quarter of a year several thousand stops consistently for the first several years. We were seeing the same estimates as to the number of what I'll call bad stops, very high, 40%, 50%. They came down to about 35% after a couple of years. But it was still the Nutter administration, and it was clear to me there was still resistance within the department of making fundamental changes. In the period 2011 to 2015, when Mayor Kenney came in, we didn't see much improvement.
When we come back.
In cases in which an officer makes a stop without reasonable suspicion, they're now subject to discipline.
This is The Why. I'm Malcolm Burnley. I'm talking with David Radofsky, one of the lawyers who sued the city 10 years ago for illegal stop and frisks. So your law firm, in looking at this data, has been seeing some improvement in the numbers of illegal stops, but has also seen evidence of racial bias in the stops that are made. What has the city had to say about this?
Of course, the police department said there are two major reasons for the disparities that are not racial in nature. One, there's more crime in black communities, and two, we have more officers there, right, because there's more crime. And so you can expect that there would be more stops because of those factors. And that's certainly a legitimate point, right? The numbers don't prove, they prove disparities, they don't necessarily prove racial bias. Our expert, with 10 years of data, was finally able to convince the city and even the city's expert that it wasn't just racial disparities, it was racial bias. In largely black communities in the city, what we found, even taking into account crime rates and police deployment, far more stops than you found in other communities, white communities, given the same population. And so we knew there was something going on because the community was black. By the same token, in largely white areas in the city, where there were lower numbers of stops, the disparities were huge. So if you took an area that was 80% white or 85% white in Philadelphia, we were finding that the stops were still over 50% black, right? And the city this summer, which is a marking point in our case, filed with the court a concession that there was racial bias, and that they were open to remedial measures to deal with the racial bias.
I know you've been speaking with members of City Hall as well as Commissioner Outlaw about some of these possible remedial measures. Could you elaborate on what those might be?
First of all, close to 40 or 45% of all stops in Philadelphia are what I call quality of life stops. It's not somebody with a gun. It's not a serious felony. It's somebody with an open liquor container. It's somebody who might be urinating in the alley. Littering, right? People could be stopped and frisked for littering in Philadelphia. Those kinds of incidents, not even misdemeanors. That's, as I say, not quite half, but close to half of all the stops.
So you suggested ending quality of life stops?
It would reduce the number of stops significantly. It would reduce the number of illegal stops, and it would reduce the racial disparities. It turns out, in quality of life stops, over 90% are minorities. Huge numbers. So that's one recommendation we've made. The second recommendation we've made that we think is very important is, in cases in which an officer makes a stop without reasonable suspicion, they're now subject to discipline, and what I'll call progressive discipline. First time it's a warning, second time it's retraining, third time it could be real discipline. So those are just two of the measures, for example, that we propose to the city. We will know in the next couple of months which ones they accept. If we're not satisfied, we can ask the court to order additional measures. And ultimately, if what the city does or doesn't do is not sufficient to cure this racial bias, as I say, we have a remedy with the court to ask the court to end stop and frisk.
According to the data you've tracked for an entire decade now, stop and frisk has been responsible for very few guns being taken off the street. Does that mean that stop and frisk has both disproportionately affected Black and brown communities and also has not been responsible for reducing crime?
Consistently, since we've been looking at this data, when we look at frisks, and that's where the officer says, not only did I have reason to stop him, but I have reason to frisk him because he's armed and dangerous. For every 100 times they frisk somebody, they find a single gun. You can almost do better randomly, I think, in Philadelphia, right? This notion that we're pulling a lot of guns off the street and stopping violent crime, not so clear.
You spoke about Mayor Kenney running on a platform that included reforming stop and frisk, but over the last few years, you know, many activists and community members have said that he hasn't gone far enough. I'm wondering, with the events of this summer, what the current political appetite is for reforming stop and frisk even further.
Mayor Kenney actually ran on an end stop and frisk program in 2015. I don't think he meant to end it completely, but that's what he ran on because it was an issue that was very important in the city. Came into office, realized he wasn't going to end it. But between him and Commissioner Ross, they, as I said, they did reduce the number, but still a gap between reality and what's going on in the streets and what should go on constitutionally. I do think you're right. The events of the last year, the confluence of events, George Floyd shooting, the overreaction to protests here, which they've had to apologize for, their admission in this case that there is racial bias, not just racial disparities, which is a huge admission. Many cities wouldn't do that. Indicates to me, I don't want to be too optimistic here, that there is a change of views. Commissioner Outlaw has underlined that, said she's willing to consider anything to make this a constitutional program. So there is some opportunity here that I've not seen in many years for some very significant changes in policing. How far it will go and whether it'll be sufficient is something we'll find out, I think, as I say, within the next several months into 2021.
Well, David, thanks for all the work over the last decade on this issue, and especially thanks for giving us the update on where things stand today.
My pleasure. I look forward to your project.
David Radofsky is a civil rights lawyer and partner at Carey's Radofsky, Messing, Feinberg, and Lynn. The Why is produced by me, Malcolm Burnley, along with Shaban Yaakov, Annette John Hall, Alex Stern, Kelsey Hansen, Sabrina Boyd Circa, and Buffy Gorilla. We get editorial direction from Ariella Cohen. You can find me on Twitter @Malcolm Burnley. We'll be back Thursday.